I was telling you right before we started that I have completely blacked out the last like 4 days of my life. I may have been in some sort of fugue state, in some sort of Tyler Durden reality where I'm starting a fight club in another city. I don't know.
I don't remember what I did this weekend either, so. Oh, yeah, I do. I do. Maybe this will jog your memory. I did have another alt-comedia show. It went really well.
No, that doesn't help. That doesn't help me at all. Welcome to another episode of the MacGuffin Podcast, the podcast that dreams are made of.
Okay.
You are Keith Foster from San Diego, California.
And you are Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
That's the new tagline. Start living with it. It's the reality that we are now in.
I don't think that people are going to get that it's a movie reference. I think they're just going to think we're like cheesy as fuck. It sounds like Katy Perry lyrics. Like, it doesn't...
You uncultured Philistine, first of all.
Okay.
And second of all...
No.
It can be.
No. Do not say what movie that is a reference to. This is a call to action for our listeners, our new listeners and our old-knit listeners alike. Tell us what you think of the new tagline... The podcast that dreams are made of.
Yes, I'm also considering the movie review podcast that dreams are made of, because it's a little more specific.
That's better. I don't know. Anyway, tweet us, email us, let us know what you think about this new tagline. And let us know, if you think you know what movie that is from, send us your guesses.
Right.
And if the first person that we get the guesses right, we'll give you a prize. You'll get a prize, but it'll be a shitty, dumb prize.
Okay. I was also going
to
say...
We have no budget, so it will probably be me leaving you like a dumb voicemail or something. But whatever, you'll get a prize.
I was also going to say it can be cheesy as fuck and a famous movie reference simultaneously.
Sure, I guess. I'm not in love with it, but it's fine. You've already printed the business cards.
We did. We have business cards. I don't know if we've ever said this on the podcast, but we might as well. We are a couple days away from going to WonderCon as the MacGuffin podcast, representatives of the MacGuffin website. And
I wasn't sure if we could say anything, so I've been holding off on like the social meds.
Right, yeah. But you know, I might as well put it out there because this will be published on Thursday and we will be headed on Friday. So if you're not following us on social media right now, either on Twitter at MacGuffin Pod or on Instagram, especially Instagram at MacGuffin Pod, you should be, because we're going to be posting pictures and stuff from inside of WonderCon in Anaheim.
And if you're going to be in WonderCon, try to find us. We can talk. I don't know. Just find us. It'll be fun. We'll give you one of these business cards.
Right. We printed up some today, in fact, to be able to network and mix it up.
That's right, bitches. We're getting legit.
not right now, we're not, but...
No, I'm very tired.
Yeah. So
this might be a loopy one.
Yeah, and we're talking about some heavy stuff today, too. We are going to be talking about Jordan Peele's Us, one of the more anticipated films of 2019. And there's a lot to talk about there. We're going to be talking at the end of the show, the Netflix homework that you assigned me, Hardcore Henry.
I'm excited to get into it.
Really?
I am.
Okay. I thought when I watched it, I was like, oh, this will probably take 5 minutes to talk about.
Really? Okay. All right. Well, we'll get there.
A little preview for things to come there. I'm going to do a little solo review of Wonder Park because I saw it. And I might as well talk about it. But before we do that, we got a few segments. The first one we usually do is our Obey Consume. The segment in which we talk about what we've been watching, what we've been listening to, what we've been reading, what are we obsessed with, Keith?
There's a new comic that came out. I like to keep mine about comic books because that's like the media I consume that isn't movies and TV.
Right.
And there's this new comic book out from Image Comic Books called Little Bird, mm-hmm. by Darcy Van Poelgeest and Ian Bertram.
Okay.
And I heard about this comic because I follow the artist on Instagram, Ian Bertram, and he has a really unique, cool art style. It's sort of Frank Quietly-esque. And I really dig his art style. And so he's been hyping this book for a while, and I picked up the first issue, and it was really cool. And at the end of the first issue, they said that they're not going to be printing it as a trade paperback anytime soon, which is kind of unusual. And I don't pick up a lot of comics issue by issue anymore.
Sure.
But my wife, she got a pull list for the first time ever in her life. She's reading a few single-ish right now. Or she's really liking the Image comic Man-Eaters as well.
Okay.
So a bunch of stuff that was teased out at Comic-Con last year, she's been actually getting into. And so I was like, oh, that's fun. We found like a fun little local comic book shop called, oddly enough, Empire Comics.
Oh, oddly, because that was the name of the comic book shop when we were living in our hometown of Pocatello, Idaho.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I think it's actually a pretty common name for comic book shops, but it probably does, like, it still gives me the feels.
Sure.
And I've been making an active choice to, because I used to buy a lot of comics from Amazon because they were cheaper, mm-hmm. But I've been making an active choice to try and shop local. So I've been paying more for single issues and trade paperbacks,
yeah.
To support local comic book shops instead of the Amazon monster.
Right.
Anyway, all of this is to say that I picked up issue one of Little Bird. It's really cool, really unique, right up my alley, kind of a sci-fi dystopian thing. Yeah, so I'm really into what they're putting down so far, and I'm hoping the next four issues are just as solid as number one.
Okay. You said the Little Birth or Little Birds?
Little Bird, B-I-R-D.
Okay.
Little Bird.
Okay, well, that sounds cool. I had to go back a couple weeks. I was telling you right before we started that I have completely blacked out the last, like, 4 days of my life. I may have been in some sort of fugue state, in some sort of Tyler Durden reality where I'm starting a fight club in another city. I don't know.
Or is it a fake fugue state like in Breaking Bad? Hmm?
If it's real, it's real. But
I don't remember what I did this weekend either. So, I do. Maybe this will jog your memory. I did have another alt-comedia show. It went really well.
No, that doesn't help. That doesn't help me at all.
Well, fuck my thing. Tell your thing.
A couple weeks ago when St. Patrick's Day weekend, me and a couple friends went to Santa Ana in Orange County, where they have a big barcade called Mission Control. Have you ever been to a barcade?
Yeah, we have a couple down here.
Sure.
Well, it's one franchise, but it's called Coin Op, and it's mm-hmm. fun.
They're fun. I said to my friends, and I believe this to be true, that the barcade is the new 50s diner. Just putting that out there, you know, discuss amongst yourselves. But we went and...
I think it's more like the new karaoke bar.
No,
like,
it's a new 50s diner. Okay. So we went and, you know, I'll first of all say if you're in the Orange County area and you're looking to go to a barcade, I think it's the best one I've been to in either LA or Orange County. It's very clean. It's very big. They have like a DJ there playing like, you know, crazy like 80s and 90s music remixes. And it has a pretty good selection of arcades and pinball machines. I'm terrible at all of them. Like, I should never be allowed in front of any kind of gaming because I'm just really, really bad at it.
So but, you don't game, you don't drink, like,
nope.
What is there?
I don't dance either.
Yeah, so what is there for you at these places?
Flashing lights? I don't know. I do enjoy going. You know what? I'll say this about the bar pub industry for somebody who doesn't drink. I'm fine with going as long as there's something for me to do. If the whole point of going,
you just said you don't play games.
No, I do play games. I just don't win them. But
okay.
if there's arcades there. And I'm not talking about like darts or pool or whatever, because that's like adult grown up games and they're not really actually that fun. But if it's an arcade or something like that I can get behind, or if there's like a pub quiz going on, then that gives me something to do. And then I feel totally comfortable in the environment. But if the whole point is just to like stand around and scream over each other and then like hit on girls or whatever, that's just not my scene. But Mission Control, that is my Obey Consume. If you happen to be in the Orange County area and you want to go to a fun barcade that has a really good selection of old games, most of which I'm terrible at, but I did have a lot of fun playing, go to Mission Control. How long has it been since you played Primal Fear? Is that what it was called?
Primal Rage.
Primal Rage. Primal Rage, yes. How long has it been since you played Primal Rage?
It's been a minute. Yeah, it's probably been a while.
It's so shitty. Like, I guess I kind of liked it as a kid or whatever, because you could be a velociraptor and your finisher move was to pee on your opponent.
Yeah, but is it... So, okay, is it shittier than say, like, any of the Mortal Kombats from that area?
Oh, yeah, significantly. Because it's a ripoff. Really? It's a Mortal Kombat ripoff, but the gameplay is terrible and clunky. The graphics terrible. It looks like they tried to like scrap it together, you know, with it on a weekend to just try and compete with a Mortal Kombat game. It's really, really bad. But I had fun kind of playing it and realizing how terrible it always was.
I get what you're saying. I think barcades are fun. I don't know. I like Coin Op. I'd check this place out.
Yeah, if you happen to be in the area, check out Mission Control. Okay, so that's really all I have. The next segment I wanted to do, normally this is where we would do our movie news, but we don't have a ton of stories yet. But I wanted to kind of resurrect a segment we haven't done in a good while. And this was something we did back in the Jabber and the Drone days. So this would be the first time on MacGuffin that we do the segment entitled
"Don't Call It a Comeback."
I don't know if I've done this.
You have.
This might have been a Richard thing.
Nope, this was with you. "Don't Call It a Comeback" is the game in which we talk about three different actors who we haven't seen in a while or haven't been as active in a while.
Okay.
And we're gonna play career coach, and we're gonna tell them what they should be doing to get people's attentions again.
That's right. I remember this now. Okay. All right. This is fun.
Yeah. I have a little list here. It's I don't know.
I feel like you get an unfair advantage though, because you pick the actors. But
I did. But I promise you, I have not thought about this too much. Other than I was just trying to think of people I haven't seen in a while who, you know, are in a physical state into which they could still be acting.
Sure.
All right. First on the list. Been a while since we've seen him. Damon Wayans. Damon okay. Wayans.
I mean, it hasn't been that long. Damon Wayans has done some TV stuff. Mm. He was in, like, the first season of New Girl. He was in, I think he's doing that Lethal Weapon television show.
Oh.
So he's not totally disappeared, but he is, he's definitely not in his
prime,
in his height.
No.
The way he was.
Well, what brought this upon my memory is they, some magazine, I don't know which one, maybe Entertainment Weekly or something, did a big reunion, like 25-year reunion photo with the cast of In Living Color.
For, yeah, yeah.
And he wasn't in it. I'm, like, counting, I'm looking, oh, really? I'm like, where the fuck is Damon Wayans?
Yeah, that was, like, him and Jim Carrey
were like, the biggest ones on the show. They had the most memorable characters.
Yeah, so what could Damon Wayans do to sort of get back in social consciousness?
Right.
This might be odd. This might be odd, but there was a news story we talked about last week where we've been talking a lot about James Gunn and his Suicide Squad.
Uh-huh.
The first thing that popped in my mind was he actually might be a fun choice to play Deadshot, to take over for Will Smith instead of Idris Elba. So that was like the first thing that came to my mind as sort of one of these mm-hmm. big budget action franchises.
Yeah.
I think could be a fun way to get his name out there. And I think a title like Suicide Squad, if it could get like an R rating and have a little bit more edge, could be a fun way to sort of reintroduce him to younger audiences who might not know his style of humor. So
right.
I'm gonna say he should be Deadshot.
Wow, okay. Yeah, that's a big leap. I guess
he can do it. Like he's kind of flirted
with
that
action a little bit. He was in Last Boy Scout and stuff.
Yeah, and he did Bulletproof and, mm-hmm. and he kind of has that sense of humor that I think you know, Idris Elba's great, and I love him, and I think he'll be great in the role, but I think Damon Wayans could have that, like, I'm a comedian edge, and it could really work well with someone like James Gunn.
Sure.
In a way that people could be like, oh, holy shit, like, where did he come from?
Yeah, yeah, okay. See, I was thinking more like Damon Wayans could be, or could reprise... Not reprise. Let me reword that. He could show up in like a Ryan Coogler, Barry Jenkins indie drama, like end of the year prestige yeah. film, and like pull this like serious thing that nobody ever really considered for him. And then, you know, probably not as the main character, but like have mm-hmm. one totally solid scene where he gets to like just like fucking
some
kill
best
it.
Supporting actor.
Yeah.
I see, that's where I thought as well, but
is that
I
too
think
obvious?
Well, I mean, that's kind of what every actor wants sort of later in their career, especially
right.
like comedians that are, you know, used to be like king of the world kind of guys.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I went against it, that instinct, was because he has been marginally active.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he needs something more than indie heat right now. I think he needs something very big, like something that just like reintroduces him to audiences in a big way. So that's why I thought more action blockbustery thing. But I will admit that I think it has to be the right type of thing for him. Like I don't necessarily see him in like a Marvel joint. I see him more as like a crazy villain in Deadpool or you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
like a rated R superhero thing. I think he could do really well with. But I mean, yeah, obviously something like that would probably be a boost to his career. I just think he needs more media heat right mm-hmm. now because he has been. You know, he's been doing some stuff.
Yeah, I'm looking at the IMDb now. He's actually in a couple of shows, it looks like. He is in that Lethal Weapon show. And he's in, let's see, what is it called? Happy Together? I don't know what that is.
I don't either. But that's the problem.
Last year.
he's staying active as an actor. He's just not, he's not doing anything that's like really hitting the pop culture consciousness. And, you know, that might be an intentional choice.
Right. What about something like a mid-level action thriller in which he's like the sort of, he's like playing like the Damon Wayans-ish type character, like obviously a little bit older, a little bit more kind of muted, but kind of playing like a Damon Wayans-ish sort of comedic side character thing to the hero. And you think it's like a buddy cop thing or like a buddy robber thing. And they're like on the road, like being chased down by some like, you know, nefarious whatever. But at the end of the movie, you find out he is the nefarious whatever.
I mean,
isn't that
yes,
fucked up? It,
my mind is blown. I think he's got to have something about the project that has more heat than he has, though. Like,
right.
If it could be like a Tarantino thing.
Well, or I mean, I think that's kind of reaching for the stars a little bit, but you know, something.
Sure,
that,
but we're talking what they need, or like even a Jordan Peele's next project, like something that's gonna bring more attention to it than his name alone. I think would be good.
Well, yeah, he would have to be playing second string to somebody much more famous than him. At this point.
Yeah.
All right. Next person on the list. Next person on the list. This one I think is going to be the hardest.
Okay. All right.
Carrie Ann Moss. Carrie Ann Moss from the Matrix movies. Trinity.
Oh, Jesus. Jesus Christ.
What should Carrie Ann Moss be doing right now?
Again, she was just in Jessica Jones. So she.
This is my problem with never watching television shows.
Yeah, well, that's also kind of like indicative of the times. Is a lot of these movie actors are doing TV now. Mm-hmm. Like even movie stars are doing TV ever since like you know, the Mad Men, Breaking Bad, like
yeah,
the John Hamms and the Bryan Cranstons. Showed how TV can be prestigious. Obviously, it's not exclusive to those two. You can go even further back to like Sopranos and stuff. But there's a lot more movie. The lines are a lot more blurred between movie and TV right now,
right,
than they ever have been. So yeah, what something she should do? I mean, she's gotta go for like she should do the prestige thing, like the. Shoot for that best supporting actress thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like if she could get something where she's playing like some kind of villain trying to undermine Meryl Streep or whatever.
Ooh, I like that.
And they're both lesbians. basically The Favorite, but with Meryl Streep and Carrie Ann Moss. Like that's what she needs is
all right.
I think that's what she's needs is she needs something to sort of legitimize her as a serious actress instead of an action actress. Because she's too old for that now, unfortunately.
Probably, yeah. Although nobody says that about Liam Neeson.
It's sexist, it's a double standard, but it's different for men in Hollywood. I'm not saying it's right, there's no judgment associated towards that. I'm just saying there hasn't been that kind of a role for women. I mean, maybe
you know
she
what?
Could do it. Maybe she could be the female Liam Neeson.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm seeing it in my head now. I had a whole different answer prepared. But why couldn't there be a gender reversal taken? Except for don't call it taken. Like, you know, but it could be about her husband getting kidnapped. And she's like a truck driver or something like that. Or she's like, you know, like... she's always on the road or whatever. For some reason, she's super prepared for this, and she's like a
logger in Canada, hauling these like giant logs to and fro across Route 66. So she has this chainsaw, and her name is the fucking name of the movie is Lady Chainsaw.
I wasn't going so exploitation as that, but. But yeah, you know, why couldn't she just like spend the whole film?
Just call it The Chain, whatever.
Why couldn't she spend the whole film just running around, kicking ass, and like, you know, jumping off of things and nearly escaping death?
You talked me into it. I'm into it.
Yeah. And but play up the age thing. Play up the fact that, you know, so that there's actual stakes in the violence. Don't make her just like this insane, like, military badass or whatever. Like, make it to where, like, you're afraid she'll be in danger, but she still scraps her way through it. That could be pretty cool.
The thing I was going to say is they kind of tried to do this a little bit in the last couple of years with Peppermint, that Jennifer Garner thing.
Yeah, nobody saw
that. And Widows.
This would have to be done by a tasteful action director, not just like
And it would also have to be like, it would have to be an action movie. Like, right. I think that's like what sort of separates Widows. I think Peppermint was more of this. But yeah, like full on, like just get the fucking guy who did Taken.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm so into that now. Forget my answer. My answer was bullshit. I want Lady Chainsaw.
My original answer was going to be that she should show up in one as a, you know, cameo in one of those Judd Apatow comedies as like somebody's like rude boss or something, but actually be hilarious, because I think the problem with Carrie Ann Moss is nobody, she seems joyless and kind of cold presence on screen, and I don't think anyone would expect her to be good at comedy, and maybe she isn't. But if she could, if that's a tool in her toolbox, now would be the time to use it.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. I can see that as well, but I prefer Lady Taken.
Yeah, I do too. Okay, last one, and this might be controversial. And this is the only one I actually looked up on IMDb beforehand. Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Now, okay. I'll say this about JGL.
No, I kind of get what you're saying. Like he's
on the bubble.
He hasn't done anything high profile in a while. The last few movies he's done have been kind of...
have tanked?
Near miss...
The last, like, pretty successful movie he was in was probably Dark Knight Rises. And that's almost 10 years old.
I mean, yes. I saw The Night Before. That was fun. Mm. But it wasn't, like, a big movie.
No. I mean, yeah, he's been in stuff like he's still out there, you know, but he's definitely peaked already.
You know what he should avoid?
What should he avoid?
He should avoid doing something with Jennifer Lawrence.
Yes. Oh, my God. Because they're both on the bubble.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the bubble's kind of popping for J-Law, but.
I think they both got a hand, like one hand hanging off of the last rung on the ladder. Like they haven't slipped yet, but they're right there. It takes they're both about one flop away from like totally being irrelevant.
So I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt, not J-Law. She's got to figure out her own problems. I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt should do like kind of a sleeper horror thriller thing.
Okay.
I like what you were describing kind of with Damon Wayans. I think something kind of lower budget, but something with a really good fucking script that you think can get some heat at like Sundance or Cannes.
Sure.
Or like
go back to his roots.
Like sort of an auteur, you know, like something Blumhouse-y.
Okay.
But it's got to be more interesting than just like your ordinary haunted demon house possession deal. Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I think maybe he should take a turn as a villain. Like he should be looking for those like Zac Efron playing Ted Bundy kind of thing. Like I think he needs to. I don't know, something that's like dark and interesting and weird. So that's what I want for him is like some kind of indie horror thing. It could even be like a Netflix thing. As long as it has some kind of hook, some kind of edge that's going to get people to walk out of the theater and go, "Whoa, I did not see that coming from the kid from Third Rock from the Sun."
Do you think anybody still thinks of him that way? If they even know what that show was.
Forever he will be Tommy in my heart.
Angels in the outfield. I actually would not go that direction. I think that at this stage in his career, that would come off as desperate. Because I think the sort of feeling people have about Joseph Gordon-Levitt right now and why they're kind of are starting to dismiss him is that he always seemed a little pretentious. And I don't mean that even necessarily in a bad way, but I mean, like, he was, you know, did a lot of indie films early on and then kind of got his name out that way and then went from that directly to being a leading man. And I think that was the problem, is I don't think he's necessarily leading man material. It's certainly not in this day and age. He See, maybe had like a moment right. there, like kind of in the 2011s, where whatever it is that he does is leading man material, but then the times change and now he totally is not, because he's never going to be like Captain Marvel or, you know, whatever. So I think he should do what I think would come most naturally to him. I think he needs to just kind of relax and play to his strengths. He's still relatively young. You know, I think he's a little bit older than us, but not by much. He's good looking and he's charming when he wants to be. Romantic comedy that is, you know, not in a kind of 500 Days of Summer thing, but kind of maybe remind people that that's what they like about him. Something that's a little bit more kind of substantive and playing opposite somebody who's a great deal more famous. Like, he would be second billing in this.
I cannot agree with you less.
Really?
Really. Like, I think that's kind of his problem, is he does...
I think his problem is he's always in stuff like Snowden and whatever that one...
He did Snowden and The Walk.
And The
like,
Walk.
You're saying he's a leading man. Most of his credits are supporting stuff. You're talking about him going back to his Don John days.
Well, Don John was the first movie he directed, and he was the lead of that. And yeah, I actually think that Don John was
he was playing opposite of Scarlett Johansson. He did this movie. He did the movie you're saying. He did it already. It's done. It's Don John. He made that movie.
But that's like
you're wrong.
That was trying to be a little bit more because
the same movie
porn addict
to recreate his. No, to me that is like that comes off as desperate. That is like him trying to like recreate one of the highlights of his career. No, it's got to be something new. We got to get something new and edgy from the kid.
All right. I think we're on a impasse on this because I think we...
He's known for romantic comedies. No, he's known for 500 Days of Summer. And I mean, 50-50 wasn't so much romantic, but it was like... Yeah, it's like an indie comedy. He needs something with some edge to it, something weird.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see. We'll have to let the listeners weigh in on this. What should Joseph Gordon-Levitt be doing right now?
Oh, Looper 2, and call it Tooper.
Well, I would don't call it that at all, but I would be totally down for a sequel to that movie because I had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah.
And I think Rian Johnson would be too, because everyone hates him right now for no reason.
Whatever. We're not going there right now. We're already going to talk about some controversial movie opinions, so I can't go there with Star Wars right now in this moment.
Okay. Well, let's start talking about the movies. I'm going to do a little solo review here of the movie Wonder Park. Keith, if you don't want any spoilers, you're probably going to have to cover your ears for a few minutes.
Are there spoilers
no.
to be had?
No.
I mean, I feel like I pretty much figured this one out from the trailers.
Yeah, I don't know. There was a few surprises in this movie, but kind of not really.
Okay.
So this is an animated film There's the young girl named June. She's being raised by her mother. They both have very active imaginations. June always dreams about a magical theme park called Wonder Park. And she, you know, plays around in her bedroom in her yard, building these complicated models and stuff of all of the different rides that are going to be in her imaginary park. And all of her little stuffed animals are characters that she talks to. And her mom is always sort of encouraging her to use her imagination and to, dream for the stars. Until one day, her mother is diagnosed with something pretty serious and leaves the house for a number of months or weeks. It's not totally clear as to how long she's been gone. But her father is kind of raising her alone while they're sort of waiting for things to settle. And during this time, June loses all interest in Wonder Park, and she wants nothing to do with it anymore because it just reminds her of her mom and makes her more worried. She's also become very paranoid about the health and well-being of her father and won't let him do anything anymore, constantly cleaning the house. So one day, her dad signs her up for math camp to get her mind off of things, and is unsuccessful because June tries to escape when she causes her bus to stop in the middle of the woods and wanders off. She finds herself in the imaginary Wonder Park that she created in her mind with her mother. And there she's able to talk to and befriend all of her stuffed animal characters. But things are a little different in Wonder Park now. The park has been unkept and the rides are shut down. And there's hordes of plushy zombie monkeys who have been released from a giant storm cloud. And is causing havoc all over the park. So it is her job to find her best friend chimpanzee named Peanut and make sure that he takes his role as the leader of Wonder Park and bring back all the rides. Still with me?
Okay. So, yeah. What did you think of Wonder Park?
I liked everything about it except for the Wonder Park stuff. I was actually kind of taken with the emotional storytelling stuff between her and her mom, and I kind of saw it coming, but I thought that was very effective, and I thought that was some, like, tough, hard stuff to teach kids. Mm-hmm. Now, this skews pretty young. When I went and saw it, this skews even a little bit younger than your average Pixar joint.
Sure. Okay.
But I think for that, they're actually tackling some real stuff and doing it fairly effectively and really setting up a lot of good foundation for story here. And obviously, the metaphors are pretty clear, dark cloud over the imaginary park that she created with her mother, blah, 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 and bringing it back to life and all of that stuff. So, with that said, kids movie doesn't have to be terribly sophisticated, and there's enough there to work on. Unfortunately, the movie's not particularly interested in the actual, Alice in Wonderland, Wizard of Oz journey stuff. Mm-hmm. So once she's there, it kind of feels like it's sort of just rushing to get through the set pieces and rushing to get her to meet all of the characters and find, the magic whatever that's going to make this all work again. And it feels like the movie just is going through the motions of getting June back to her regular reality so that they can just kind of finish out. So the movie sort of loses its nerve halfway through and doesn't actually pull through with the emotional metaphors that it set up at the beginning of the movie. Which is kind of disappointing because I felt like there was a big opportunity to really go for it on that stuff. And obviously, if you see like a movie like Inside Out, which is kind of similar in some ways, the stuff about our lead character, the 12-year-old girl, and then all the stuff that's sort of in the imaginary a world in her mind are equally interesting and are sort of, balancing each other. In this movie, not so much. It's t- two distinct levels of quality in the storytelling between one and the other. And I think the problem is that the people who put this together and the animators and, you know, when it comes to like character design and world building and that kind of stuff, just don't have a lot of imagination. The characters aren't super memorable. They don't really bring a lot to the story. They don't really seem to represent anything. Like in June's world, they're just kind of cute animals.
Cute cartoon animals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And there was some desperate script revision that was needed here, and then a little bit more creativity in the character design and the set design. Unfortunately, it kind of putters out, but I don't know.
I have a question. Is it funny? Is it entertaining? Like, do you think kids would like it? Is it even though it's not like, you know, Pixar level, mm-hmm. right? You know, if you think about like a lot of the cartoons we liked as kids, we still have a soft spot in our heart for them. Like one of the ones I'm thinking of, and this might be, maybe a higher quality movie, but like Brave Little Toaster, right?
You know,
is sort of like a forgotten childhood classic that deals with some real feelers.
Right.
And some real issues. Like, how does it rank when you compare it to sort of other kids' movies that are dealing with sort of heavier subjects and stuff?
I don't think it's as good as that.
Brave Little Toaster is sort of an unsung classic, so maybe that's
a little
a hard one to.
Yeah,
to
I do think
to,
that.
But I just mean,
I do think that kids in general, if you're just looking for an electric babysitter, if you just need to plug something in and keep them occupied for an hour and a half.
Well, that's the most cynical way of saying the same thing.
Sure, but I'm saying it would effectively do that. It's entertaining enough. It's not a terrible movie, and it's well-meaning, but mm-hmm. I think that, you know, if I'm looking at it objectively, it really misses an opportunity, especially because it kind of promises a lot at the front of the movie and doesn't deliver.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, but yes, you know, if you're under 10 years old, you know, you're probably going to have fun with it.
Cool.
Yeah, and there's even within that, there's worse movies. You know, there your average singing cute animal movies are going to be worse than Wonder Park.
Okay, cuz that's kind of all I was expecting from it was sort of that. Mm-hmm. So it is good to know that there might be a little bit more, even if shallow, there's something else behind.
Yeah, it's trying. It's trying. It just fails in some weird ways.
Okay, do you want to give it a letter grade?
What did I give it? I think I gave it like a C. Like the C average. All right. Let's go to the movie people really want us to talk about. And I'm sure, you know, there's a lot to unpack here. We're going to talk about Jordan Peele's Us. Go ahead and describe what's happening there.
Okay. So without getting into spoiler territory, the basic setup of the movie is there is this family. This black family who is vacationing in some kind of summer home near Santa Cruz, some kind of cabin-y area.
Mm-hmm.
There's some history with this area, and the matriarch of the family, played by Lupita Nyong'o, Adelaide Wilson, she doesn't want to go back to the beach at Santa Cruz because she remembers... Mm-hmm. She doesn't really remember, but she knows she has some, like, traumatic childhood memory about this time she got lost when she was a kid in this funhouse. She remembers this experience where she saw a little girl who looked just like her. And as she starts to notice more and more coincidences of sort of mirror things occurring... that evening, their family gets assaulted by a group of a family that looks just like them.
Yes.
And then horror hijinks ensue.
Right.
Yeah, so that's sort of the plot without any of the spoilers or even really like a lot of the thematic work going on.
Yes. That's the nuts and bolts. That's what you saw in the trailer.
Yeah, yeah. So do you want to talk about some of other people's reactions, or do you want to lay out sort of your feelings on the movie first?
I think before we even get to that, I kind of want to frame this a little bit. This is the much anticipated follow-up from Jordan Peele to the film Get Out, which was kind of a surprise hit to some extent for a horror film, for a genre film, certainly.
Kind of a lower budget horror too.
It was produced through Monkey Paw / Blumhouse. That sort of production was his first big directorial movie. And Jordan Peele, known for doing comedy largely in Mad TV and the Key and Peele sketch shows. It was something of a surprise that he had this kind of darker edge in him and, you know, an eye for cinematography and you know, capable genre filmmaking. It did so well that he even garnered a Oscar nomination for it.
Did he win?
For best screenplay, I think.
He won. He won an Oscar for Get Out.
And yeah, so, you know, he went from the guy who was on Key and Peele to being an Oscar-winning screenwriter doing a horror film. And not just any kind of horror film, a pretty wacky sci-fi horror film, you know.
With a lot of social subtext, a lot of racial subtext.
Right.
It was definitely a right movie at the right time.
Yes, certainly. And this movie, I think, is, in a lot of ways, the logical next step from that. I suspect, I haven't talked to you about it. We've seen some reactions online, and we'll get to those. But I suspect that this film is going to be a little bit more difficult for people because this is a little, there's a lot more, you know, plot-wise going on. There's a lot more kind of strange and surreal aspects to this movie. And I think that...
Unlike Get Out,
mm-hmm.
Which was also chock full of symbolism, the connections aren't as easy.
Right.
With some of the visual metaphors and symbols that he's working with. This movie, I think, asks something of its audience. It in a way that I love Get Out. I love Get Out. But in a way that I don't think Get Out did.
Mm-hmm.
I think Get Out is the type of movie, it pretty much tells you everything that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
It lays it out in really clever and sophisticated ways. That movie sort of solves all its mysteries. It sort of wraps everything up in a very digestible way.
Yeah, I think that Get Out is a lot more of a pop horror film than this film is. And I think that, you know, they both aren't in some degrees of each other as far as that goes. This certainly isn't as abstract as you can get. But I do think it is a little fussier, and I do think it is a little bit more challenging.
Yes, and I think those are good things.
I do too. I do too. And I think that this is, you know, the people who jumped on the Get Out bandwagon, you know, as 2016 was rolling through and there was, you know, more and more acclaim and, you know, word of mouth. I think the people who kind of jumped on late and weren't there because they like horror films are going to maybe divide that audience of people who just go to see what's big and what's being talked about and the people who go because they like horror films.
Yeah, yeah. So some of the things I've seen from people is I've seen some people saying, like, there's too much sort of visual metaphor going on, mm-hmm. and it doesn't all work together cohesively, some people, I think, have some issues with the ending, and think that there's so many concepts being sort of thrown out that they don't all work. In my response to that, and this is just sort of a broad response to not to anyone specific, but to just sort of general takes I've seen, is that it's not a bad thing that this movie doesn't give you all your answers.
Right.
It purposely leaves things questionable. It purposely raises question. It purposely raises questions of the audience. And I think part of that is to get people to talk about it in a way that most people don't talk about movies.
Right.
And so for me, that's really exciting on one hand is to see so many people talking about movies. But it is also very frustrating to see so many people immediately dismissing this movie because it's because it doesn't give you all the answers.
Can I make a weird comparison?
Sure.
Okay.
Please do.
In 1993, when Nirvana released In Utero, MTV did a little promo for the release of the album. They went to a public campus somewhere and just handed the CD to like 12 different students and said, "Oh, well, what did you think of? What do you think of Nirvana? What do you think of Nevermind?" And you know, obviously, big hit album. Everyone's like, "Yeah, I love them." Blah 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 blah. Then they said, "Well, go ahead and you'd have the CD for free. Come back. We're going to tomorrow and we'll talk about it." And then they did another set of interviews. And at the time, now this is before Kurt Cobain died and became, you know, a legend and whatever. This was just a hot new rock band. They went back and said, "So what'd you think of In Utero?" And a lot of people were kind of like, "You know, like I like this song and that song's okay, but a lot of it's kind of different. I don't know what they're going for here," which is kind of funny to think about now because everyone has sort of just canonized the whole Nirvana catalog as being uniformly brilliant. Yeah. Yeah. But Nevermind was not received, In Utero was not received as well as Nevermind because it was a more challenging record and a, you know, less direct pop songwriting. And I think that this, in a similar way, is kind of you know going from Get Out, and this is very much a spiritual successor to it, and I think definitely belongs in the same body of work, but is to some extent sort of like, okay, I see you, audience. Let's see if you can do this now. Like, I'm going to grow you a little.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I don't think that's a weird metaphor at all. I think it's I'm really glad that this movie doesn't it doesn't feel like it's pandering. It feels like it is like, I've got some heat on me. I'm going to make a movie I want to make. And you know what? We've been talking to it so much about like other people's reactions and other people's takes. I haven't gotten to tell you about how much I fucking loved this movie.
Yeah, I did too.
I was just delighted by it. Mm-hmm. I actually was a little hesitant to see it, not because I was afraid that it wouldn't be good or whatever, but because like the trailer freaked me out too much. I was like, I don't know if I can handle a whole movie of this. And as I was watching the movie, it was just like the total opposite of fear. It was just elation. I was like, oh my fucking God, like I'm loving this. Mm-hmm. I was watching it the way I watch like a John Carpenter horror movie where I'm like noticing the moves he's making and like trying to figure out what stuff I'm in. And I loved that I was like, ooh, what does this represent? Like I was hungry for it. I was like actively like trying to find those answers, those clues, like trying to interpret what this means and stuff. And then again, sort of the post movie conversation has also led me there. Like, I love that it's this big pop cultural thing that people are talking about. That really excites
me. It's a cool moment for Jordan Peele because I think because he was previously famous doing other things, it has sort of elevated these films that normally these type of movies that do get made, and you know, there's lots of great little genre films that come out all the time, and a lot of them are usually end up in my top 10 list or whatever. But they don't get the same kind of like moment in the sun that Jordan Peele does, mm-hmm. because there's not this kind of fame factory behind him that propels it in this way.
Anticipation.
Yeah, and the fact that people...
The hype of his sophomore release of this right. huge movie that everyone was so excited when he won his Oscar.
Right.
You know, it...
And so we get to live in this cool moment where we're seeing a new talent sort of emerge, and then people are really excited to see everything he does. And that's cool. I'll say this about Us. I enjoyed it a lot. I might like it more than Get Out. I've only seen it once, so I can't say that for certain yet.
I'm kind of there with you. But I'm kind of there with you.
I think,
I love Get Out. It was, I think it might have been my favorite movie that year.
Yeah.
But I just loved this so much. I loved that it wasn't, I love that he was kind of dealing with similar issues, mm-hmm. but in a way that was less on the nose.
Right. And kind of getting there in different ways. And I think yeah. this is, you know, just on an aesthetic level, I think this is a darker film. This is a, mm-hmm. I think, scarier horror film.
I saw it with my friend Andrew, and mm-hmm. he brought up a good point that I think is worth mentioning. He said, you know, this is a horror movie longer than Get Out is.
Right.
And I agree with that. Like, Get Out is sort of this really slow build to this very sort of horrific climax.
Right.
Whereas this is like... pretty early on,
and Get Out has a lot
horror,
right? And Get Out has a lot more levity, generally speaking. I mean, I wouldn't call it a horror comedy per se, but it's right on the edge of that. Whereas this one, I don't think is all that interested in that at all. I think, you know, there's some one liners and stuff, but it's
and I think he's so good at sort of like tension relief through humor.
But I think that this movie, he actually withholds that more, and he lets the tension build even more so. And you know what? I'm going to say this. I think it's hilarious that you liked it as much as you did, because there is long stretches of this movie that's directly referencing Funny Games.
I think that movies can reference other movies and be better than them. I think that to me this is I get what you're saying, but mm-hmm. you know, Funny Games didn't invent the home invasion.
No. But there are, I mean, if you're playing that game, if you're watching this just to watch the movie references, you know, there's a few. And I posted an article both on our Facebook sure. and on our Twitter of the 7 films that influenced. This film, both Funny Games and The Strangers were mentioned in that. But there's specific visual references to that movie. It's not just the idea of like a home invasion thing. But you know, you have the boat in the back, and you have
And there's like
the living room setting, and even some of the camera moves and that kind of stuff. But then there's also people have also mentioned the Wes Craven film People Under the Stairs at the very beginning of the movie, and I made myself conscious to do this. We see, a small or a really slow pull in to a television, and right next to it, there's a little stack of VHS tapes, at which point I tilted my head to read the titles because I knew that those would be relevant. Mm-hmm. And one of them is an 80s B movie called Chud about sewer dwellers.
Sure. Yeah. I think movies can reference movies and be better than sort of like, I think you can learn cool lessons from the past, but still be better than those movies. I hated Funny Games because I think it's trash. but I think a big part of it is because that movie has its head so far up its ass and tries to make these moves that to me don't pay off and totally undersell whatever reality they've built. This movie doesn't do things like that. It does offer, you know, a lot of subtext and stuff, but it doesn't sacrifice the story I'm watching for that. Mm-hmm. So I can see what you're pulling from, but I think that this is still a much more pop and commercial movie than Funny Games sure. ever is.
Sure, but what I but one of the things I one of the things I like about this movie, and where I think the different kind of influences it's pulling as opposed to Get Out is to me this movie feels a little bit more European in style.
Yeah, I can see
and
that.
I don't mean that necessarily in like you know, the characters or the language or anything like that, but just the, you know, sort of the dynamic that was set in the 60s and 70s when the European New Wave was happening at the same time as the American New Wave is that American films, generally Hollywood films, are more interested in storytelling. European films are more interested in mood. And I feel like this movie is a little bit more of a mood piece than a yeah, story piece, yeah. Even though there is, you know, cool stuff going on in the story as well.
I can see that. I can see why you even bring it up, but for the record, I still think Funny Games is trash.
I want you to have a conversation with Jordan Peele about that.
fuck, I would love that. Are you kidding me?
No, I know.
Yeah. I would honestly, I would just talk about how I'm glad he, like, took the cool stuff away from Funny Games, because it does have some good stuff in it,
mm-hmm.
But how he was able to take his influences and make an actual good movie that people would want to watch.
So we've talked a lot about sort of the movie generally. Oh, I guess we should, talk about the cast a little bit. Lupita Nyong'o is great in this movie. This is her movie.
She's revelatory.
Playing... opposite her, you know, she's, you know, burying an accent very well, which is just difficult generally. But she's doing so that really well. There's a lot of dimensions to the character.
I mean, the entire cast is good though.
Winston Duke is the husband.
Very, and he's playing so against his, what we know him as from Black Panther.
Mm-hmm.
That was just thrilling to me to see him play, you know, just sort of this dorky dad character,
mm-hmm.
Which is funny to me because there were times when I would see his character and I would almost think like, well, this feels the most like Jordan Peele. Like this feels right. like Jordan Peele putting himself in the movie
a little bit. Yeah.
But I liked that he didn't play the role. I liked mm-hmm. And I think Winston Duke pulls it off great. Elizabeth Moss and
Tim Heidecker yeah.
have smaller roles, but they're really great. The kids.
And they have a lot to do, too. Like, this whole cast, probably Elizabeth Moss and Tim Heidecker the least, because they're sort of cameos, but this mm-hmm. whole cast has a lot to do. And it's a very intimate cast, but throughout the movie, all of them have you know, lots of dynamics to play.
And they would have a lot to do even if they weren't all dual cast.
Right. Right.
So that's the other part of it, is they're playing these fully fledged, interesting characters, and then they also get to play, like, you know, sort of the dark aspect, the mirror image of those characters. So that is, as an actor, really cool as well, to see them get to sort of, you know, set up all this stuff and then play with it in fun, cool ways.
Absolutely. So now we're going to head into spoiler zone. Skip forward ahead to the hour and 21 minute mark to hear the conclusion of our review of Us and our discussion of Hardcore Henry.
You're about to enter the spoiler zone.
Yes.
And I want to kind of kick that off with this email we got here from friend of the show, Ashley, not your wife, but the other Ashley. She kind of, you know, had sort of mixed feelings. Even just through this email, her opinion is sort of evolving. but let's read it. It says, hey, so my opinion on Us, on the Us movie's ending, was that it's not really rewarding. I mean, we find out that the real Adelaide, Lupita Nyong'o's character, is dead, and Red, her doppelganger, has been the mom all along. So, spoiler. If you at the end of the film, we find out that when they were kids, that the doppelganger, you know, switches lives with her, and that we've been seeing her, the doppelganger.
The sort of real Adelaide has been the villain the entire time.
Right. It's like, so what? She loves those kids, and they consider her their mom. If the real Adelaide came upstairs, they would kill her. She hasn't really, she isn't really their mom and doesn't share their memories as a family. And then she kind of compares it to Get Out a little bit. She says also Get Out is very racially charged, and wondering if the tethered, that's what they call all of the doppelgangers who live underneath the ground, underneath the, you know, in the underworld of this movie, are a big metaphor for repressed people of color. And the whole thing stems from an abandoned government experiment, so they are commenting on government. So she's kind of, you know, she's kind of doing what I was doing as I was watching the movie. I was just trying to sort of pick it apart. Now, when I first saw the trailer, I had kind of assumed that this doppelganger metaphor was about people of color, privileged people of color or affluent people of color who are, always have the specter of their past sort of looming behind them. And, you know, this, you know, they're, you know, the person who wrote this movie is Jordan Peele, who is now wildly successful and probably very wealthy. And there's probably a weirdness to that, to being a person of color. We're saying this now as very white people, but being a person of color, and then, you know, quote unquote, making it and seeing, you know, the subjugation of your people still very prevalent in society. And then, you know, trying to sort of balance how you balance success with responsibility, or, you know, do you become a spokesperson for your people? I'm sure there's a lot of, uncomfortable weirdness around that. And that was what I always thought the doppelganger metaphor was about. And I think to some extent it is about that. But as it goes on, you know, past the stuff you see in the trailer, and we find out more and more about this underground, world of doppelgangers and rabbits and, you know, weird stuff. And I hand it to Jordan Peele. When he makes a horror film, or when he goes and does genre, he is, like, not afraid to go high concept at all.
No, not at all. I want to address a couple of the questions she brings up.
Sure.
Since we're talking about sort of this idea of, you know, the subjugation of the tethered.
Yeah.
I do think that, yes, race is definitely a part of that conversation.
Yes.
But I don't think that's the only part of that conversation.
No.
To me, and again, something I like about this movie is I do think it's sort of open to different interpretations. I think more of the race issue comes from like the dynamic between the families. So like, you know, Winston Duke's character literally wants everything that Tim Heidecker's character has.
Right.
Even though his family unit is actually probably, you know, at least as we see in the film, a closer family, you know. So I think a lot of the race stuff comes out through sort of the more mundane parts of the movie. The way I interpreted this, the tethered, was, and I think there's a few key lines here, in some key imagery, is America's and sort of middle class America's relation to otherness. So whatever that otherness could be, it could be race, it could be classism, it can be, you know, homelessness or poverty, it can be sexism. Whatever that is the tethered, and the way we ignore that. And I think it's broader than race, but race is still a part of that. Right. I think it's like the way we deal with anything we're uncomfortable with. We just want to shut it away in a basement.
And we don't want to think about it.
Pretend it's not there.
Yeah. Agreed. I thought, especially once they introduce a separate doppelganger family of Tim Heidecker Elizabeth Moss's, you know, I had to rethink that theory a little bit. And, you know, when we get to the big reveals at the end and all the monologues and all that stuff and a little bit of an info dump, I kind of, you know, especially the Hands Across America stuff that's going on in the movie. Which was a exactly. big 80s, a weird 80s campaign where they tried to get everybody from Sea to Shining Sea to join hands for a moment. And it was like a big, I think, mostly hokey attempt at sort of pretending that everything was a lot better than it was.
And the idea of it was to specifically, like, solve homelessness and solve poverty and solve American hunger.
Right. So I think this movie is maybe even more about class in that sense.
Yeah.
Although, but you know, when you're talking,
I think it's broader than class, though. I think it's just the idea of things that are outside of ourselves.
Right.
Things that are different. And so, okay, so this brings me. I know I'm going a little insane with, like, my conspiracy theories. You should see my wall with all the pictures and the yarn tied together.
Right.
So this brings me back to her original question with the idea of Adelaide and Red switching and why I think this is about the fear of the other more than anything else. So there is this old folklore legend, the legend of the changeling.
Right.
And the idea of this legend is that fairies and elves would sneak into a house at night and they would steal a human child and they would replace that child with a fairy child or an elf, and they would be impish. And this was sort of a folklore tale to explain, like, sudden changes in a child's behavior and things like that. But it was this sort of folklore tale associated to this idea of explaining, you know, this fear of parenthood, this fear of, you know, what if this baby I'm raising isn't who I think they are? And so I think that the fact that Adelaide switches with Red is key to this. It is the changeling story. And the changeling in this case is one of these tethered that gets to be raised as a human, who gets to experience that life.
Right.
And the fact that who we would normally think is the protagonist is actually the antagonist of the film, it makes it so it's morally questionable as to, you know, whether or not they're even, like, who's in the right? Who is actually the villain of this story? And that's what I love about it.
Yeah, I think that's the key to the entire thing, actually, because I don't even think it's necessarily appropriate to call her or either of them the villain or the antagonist.
Yes.
Because I think the larger question that the film is asking is the question of opportunity and how that changes everything. You know, they talk about, you know, a lot of times when people talk about privilege in culture, you know, it's sort of unfortunately it's sort of a controversial thing to talk about, because, you know, people who are, you know, like, well, you know, why everyone has a chance to make it for themselves and everyone has their own opportunities, blah, blah, blah. But in reality, when you're talking about privilege, you're talking about, it's not about, you know, everyone following the same rules. It's about, where are you in the starting point? And oftentimes in culture, specifically when it comes to race, you know, white people are much further down the yard line at the starting point. And and I think that, you know, when we see these two different worlds and we see these doppelgangers and who are living these kind of weird variations on what's happening up above. And I think that Jordan Peele is trying to have a conversation about class and opportunity and how that just changes everything about you. So yes, the doppelganger who normally would be this kind of like wandering zombie got to live it in a completely different life, and she's clinging onto it for, you know, for everything. And I think the character does love her kids and does love her husband. I don't see her as like being a nefarious actor the whole movie.
And the character that switches, the original Adelaide, you know, she's the only one
you can totally sympathize with her too and see where she's coming from.
Absolutely. And it makes sense why she's the only one that can talk, and mm-hmm. and why the other doppelgangers wouldn't hurt Adelaide. You know, this is personal. Yes, this was their opportunity to raise up, but there is a personal vendetta there as well. So honestly, I love fucking social metaphor in my horror movies. That's one of the reasons why John Carpenter stands out so much to me. We talk about fucking They Live almost weekly on this goddamn podcast.
Right.
And this is, we literally name a segment after it.
Right.
And to me, this movie was firing on all those same engines. It's just like the real horror isn't the home invasion. It's not, murders. These people. Yeah. Those are horrific events.
Right.
But you could say just as horrific is this everybody turning a blind eye to this horrible subjugation of an entire people, that even if they knew about.
Yeah.
Would they do anything to help them? This movie makes the argument that no, they wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot to think about here. And I think that, I definitely want to see it again before it's out of theaters. I think that, I've specifically not read anything about this. I haven't looked at, I know that Jordan Peele released his own sort of, answers.
I've read some of Jordan Peele's answers. They're not as... he's definitely still leaving things vague. Okay. I think that he wants... this is me sort of reading into it, but I think that he wants people to sort of take their own meaning from it.
Sure. Well, most artists and filmmakers want people to do that. I didn't want to read anything because I didn't want any leads before I, was able to get my thing out there. But now that I have, I might look at that stuff. Supplemental material, and then go back and watch it again. But I think that's, the sign of great art. Now,
I also think that some people say that it's sort of overloaded with visual metaphor that doesn't really pay off. Again, I disagree with that.
I don't think so. Yeah.
I think that everything is sort of on screen for a specific reason. And, if you can't figure that reason out, that doesn't mean it's a bad movie. No. If anything, I think that makes it a better movie.
I don't think it's forcing metaphor. I think that it is definitely using metaphor. But I do think that you can enjoy this movie without that. I think that if you...
That's something I said was even if none of this had any ulterior meaning other than, there are literally...
If you were just reading it in a literal...
Yeah, it's still dope as fuck.
It's really well made. It's really I'd think fairly scary for a mainstream horror film.
It definitely has its thrills.
Yeah, tense and it's very atmospheric. My only complaint with it is I think he holds back a little too much sometimes. Specifically when it comes to the violence and the amount of danger he allows his characters to be in. I think the core family, have too many near escapes within the film where...
Yeah, I was kind of expecting somebody to die, but...
I'm not saying that one of them needed to die, but I think that they're... Given how everybody else, we see all of these insane murders all over the place. And then this family just happens to get way too lucky way too often in the film.
So, okay. Because I was thinking about that as I was watching it as well.
That could have been intentional.
And I think, I think there's a purpose to that. So something specifically about this family that's different is they actually get to see and interact with their own doubles in a way that nobody else gets.
Yeah.
And this plays out in specific plot points as well. But I think again, we're talking visual metaphor here. Literally every single one of these family members has to defeat their dark other.
Right.
And I think that, especially coming from an artist, there's a lot you can say about having to defeat that, you know, that inner critic inside your head, having to defeat that person who's saying that you're not good enough, you're not... I think, again, it's very intentional that each person in this family has to defeat themselves.
Okay.
I don't think it's accidental at all. But I do think that I do agree with you that there are a couple moments where it does feel like the violence is a little oddly played off screen.
Right. And then it could have been, there could have been cuts for rating or whatever. You never know with these type of things. But I do feel like there's opportunity in this film, especially more so than Get Out. I think there's opportunity where he could go more extreme with the violence. He could
push it a little.
He could go, and earn it. And I feel like there's places in the film where they purposely do things off camera, or they're kind of shielding the violence in sort of safe ways.
I do agree with that, but again, the thing about the family unit having to defeat themselves just supports my theory that the tethered represent non-specific otherness,
mm-hmm.
and not any specific like classism or racism. I think that's, there are those things dealt with individually within this larger idea of how we deal with ideas we're uncomfortable with. I think it's more in how we deal with those issues.
Well, there's a quote at the beginning of the film where he talks about, you know, there's all these abandoned tunnels that are not being used, and it just kind of mm-hmm. leaves you with that as the film, fades from black. And I think that even that sort of evokes like Underground Railroad and that sort of stuff too.
Yeah.
It's all very interesting. Go see Us.
It's so fucking good.
If you're hearing this part of the review, you've already probably seen it because we did the spoilers, see it again.
You might also, I know some people might need to hear something like this to sort of help get them into the movie because mm-hmm. especially lately, like, we don't have a lot of huge commercial hits that do ask their audiences to dig into things deeper and to think about these kind of metaphors. So it's okay to be frustrated by that.
Right.
In fact, I think it's encouraging. If you wanted to like the movie, but something was holding you back, I encourage a second viewing with maybe some of these things in mind.
A lot of my favorite, movies, horror and otherwise, were not totally obvious to me the first time, or grew on me after time, or I came back to them and was able to get different reads from them at different stages of my life. So
I would say it's if you're really into movies, if you're really into the visual language of film, or maybe it's sort of your first sort of delving into a critical theory of a movie, I'd say give it another chance. I firmly believe this is the kind of movie that will reward multiple viewings.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about something else.
You don't want to letter grade it?
Oh, I'm going to give it
for us.
I'm going to give an A-. Yeah. I mean, I really liked it. I liked it a lot. I need a little bit more time with it to marinate, but there's a lot to appreciate.
A plus for me. Hard A+.
All right. Now let's get into the Netflix homework, which you assigned me, another highbrow film. I'm sure it will lead to a lot of discussion. Hardcore Henry, 2015 film by Ilya Naishuller?
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
This was, sort of a mid-budget action film that came out of nowhere, didn't do a ton of business in theaters, but the main conceit is that it is an action film, sort of nonstop, what were those movies that Jason Statham was in where he had the thing implanted in him?
Crank,
the Crank movies, kind of like those, but all done from a first-person perspective. So, you know, we, our eyes are the character's eyes, and we only see his, you know, hands and feet as he's running around, jumping off of things, and, you know, tumbling down buildings, being shot at, and avoiding explosions the whole movie. He's some sort of cyborg. Government sort of experiment gone wrong. We awaken in some sort of tank in the middle of the sky, and then he's immediately attacked, and it's pretty much just trying to figure out who he is, where he's going, you know, what his memories are, and trying not to get killed the whole movie. Chartel Copley shows up a lot.
a lot?
Yeah.
It's a lot of different characters.
Plays a lot of different characters. He's definitely having a ton of fun in this movie. And Tim Roth is in there as well, but not nearly as much. What did you think of Hardcore Henry?
Okay. I kind of went on a journey with this movie.
Another journey.
Yeah. So I mean, I try to watch any of these Netflix movies with like kind of a grain of salt.
Right.
I feel like whatever. I think ultimately broad picture is this movie is more of a fun experiment than an actual movie.
Right.
It honestly, a lot of times feels like you're playing a video game, but without the satisfaction of feeling like you achieved any of these things.
Right.
So I think it's, again, just more of a film experiment than anything. And like I've watched, you know, YouTube videos with guys on GoPros jumping off of buildings and stuff. And I get sort of the thrill of that. So I expected this movie to be just a total piece of shit. I didn't even know, like, Charlton Copley or Eli Roth were even in it.
Tim Roth.
Tim Roth. Yes, Eli Roth, I'm not a fan of. and admittedly, Tim Roth is in a very, very small cameo.
Right.
So, like, I didn't think, I wasn't expecting anything from this. So when like Charlton Copley shows up, I'm like, oh, okay. Okay. And ultimately I think there are some sequences that work that are like genuinely pretty fun and pretty thrilling. But I think a lot of it is kind of a jumbled mess of, that's really incoherent. And I don't know how you could have got some of those cooler moments without the gimmick, the first person gimmick. But I think there are still some gems there. And I think as much as this, this movie is both very hard to watch at times and very fun to watch at times. I think there's some genuinely pretty fun sequences. Like I would see a crazy Chateau Copley shooting up a strip club. Like I could watch that as a whole movie.
It's a weird thing to say. It's a weird sentence.
It is. I think the script is pretty dumb.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think that's kind of the biggest problem with this movie is they sort of tried to over justify it and like mash these sci-fi concepts into a movie that really didn't need it. But like the sequence where Chateau Copley is like going through his bodies and the dance.
Oh yeah, that's the best scene in the whole movie by far.
Exactly. And I'm like, how could we have set this up to get sort of more moments like that?
As far as I'm concerned, the movie's quality from scene to scene varies in the amount of Chateau Copley we have in it.
Yes. I agree with that. I kind of went between like absolutely hating the villain and totally
loving him. I was always pro villain. He's ridiculous. He's a ridiculous person.
He is, and he's what this movie needs.
Yeah.
Like he knows exactly what he's doing. He's playing a goddamn video game main boss.
The whole movie's a video game. And that's what I kept saying to myself as I was watching it. It's like, you know, there's kind of a cliche out there of like older, stuffy critics who've never actually played video games calling every action film that's a little too busy for them video game-like. This is a motherfucking video game. Like, if there was ever a movie to use that level of criticism on, down to the bad dialogue, the bad, like, expository dialogue that is just meant to take the character from one place to another.
The character literally doesn't say a word.
No, zero personality. So you're completely putting yourself into it, which is kind of, again, you know, I watched this on my TV, which is, you know, 30 something inches. It's an okay TV, but I would imagine the experience in a theater would probably, some of this would pay off a little bit more. But I think one of the biggest problems with this movie isn't just the fact that there's really no story to be had or characters to really invest yourself in, more so that the experiment of the film of doing it in first person rarely pays off because the camera work is so shoddy the whole time.
Yes.
Like, you can't enjoy an action sequence because the camera is shaking all over the place. They're using, like, fisheye lens, so everything's distorted and weird anyway.
Totally. And it's frustrating because, like, you can tell there's some really great choreography and some really great scene, stunt action going on.
But you can't decipher any of it.
Most of it is totally muddy. There are a few sequences that stand out. At the beginning, when he almost falls off the plane, I was genuinely like, oh shit. Basically, if it was anything, any kind of action sequence that didn't result in sort of close combat or result in him sort of like falling over or getting knocked down. So like the scene where he's on the motorcycle with the fucking minigun was insane.
Yeah, that was, I think that was, is that the one where he's kind of like following the bus and they're shooting at him? He's shooting.
Yeah.
Him.
Yeah.
That was probably one of the easier to read, action sequences in the film.
The scene near the end where him and Chartel Copley were busting out of the lab, and there's like all these guys sort of invading, this abandoned building. That sequence worked pretty well for me. Anytime it relied more on, again, sort of like the main character's distance from the action itself, which again made it more frustrating because I think there were some great action sequences, but for the most part, they're so jumbled and hard to watch that I do think the experiment sort of fails its own conceit for a lot of it, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, because that's the whole gimmick of the entire thing.
Yeah, that's what you want out of this movie.
Yeah, and I think, you know, basically my takeaway of it is it's pretty much a bad movie, but I do think it goes by quickly. It is kind of entertaining, specifically just for the
other. I think it's very entertaining.
Just for the sort of the trashy chaos of it all, and you know, there's an aspect of it that's a little bit sort of a modern exploitation film that I can kind of get behind. Mm-hmm. Not trying to be elevated in any kind of way, but is also sort of enjoying the stuff that it's doing or trying kind of to some extent to do something new with it. So I commend any film that challenges form in some sort of way. I don't think it does that well.
I agree. I think most of the time it falls very flat. Yeah. I agree. But I think, there's a lot of interest in sort of replicating the video game experience into cinema for some reason, which I don't know why they can't just be separate art forms, especially now that video games are getting more and more complex. But there's a number of attempts to try and sort of replicate that on screen. And I think that Hardcore Henry at least stands out for trying to replicate the actual experience of playing a video game,
right,
as opposed to just like adapting a video game property. So even though I do think ultimately it is sort of a mess, I think it's interesting enough and fun enough that it's worth your time. It's a pretty breezy movie. It moves pretty quick.
Yeah.
Just don't expect anything from it. Like, it is
the lowest of expectations. I'm not going to say that this is for everybody. I think
that
90% of people are going to think this is garbage, because it is. This is a garbage movie.
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of, you know, if you put the whole thing in quotation marks, there's entertainment to be had. But you have to sort of have an appreciation for trash.
Yes, I agree with all of that.
Or as people in the academic world would call this, sort of a paracinematic experience. And also, sort of on that note, it would be interesting to see a double feature of this movie with the old film noir Lady in the Lake that was also done in a first-person perspective.
Oh, I didn't.
Yeah, it was based on a Chandler novel. Philip Marlowe story, but it's all told like, you know, the only time you see the character is if he's looking in water, if he's looking in the mirror or something.
I wanted a few more of those kind of things,
yeah,
too. Like, I wanted to at least, like, see the character at some point.
You see him rip his chest open.
Yeah,
and pull out robot
parts.
That's
what I mean. There's, like, these insane moments that I'm like, okay, I kind of wanted to hate the movie.
Do you think the guy who made this, he just saw that, like, that first little bit of RoboCop when he's waking up in the bed and they're, like, doing experiments on him, and they're like, what if the whole fucking, like, movie was that?
That would be cool if you were, like, if you were RoboCop. If you were, like, the RoboCop and you're running around shit. And they make these fucking GoPros now, bro, that you could just, like, that could be the camera.
Right.
I hope my vaguely
Eastern European accent
wasn't too offensive for our listeners.
Definitely was. All right, so that's that. You know, it is what it is. I am going to have us watch probably something that's not terribly better than this, but Netflix just released a Motley Crue biopic called The Dirt. I think it's based on a book, maybe. A tell-all. I have to watch it anyway. So we're gonna be talking about that.
Tell people that.
That's gonna be our Netflix homework for next week.
Okay.
And that is the episode. Basically, if anybody has anything they want to say about anything we talked about, this, you know, your interpretation of the movie Us, or what you would do with Joseph Gordon-Levitt's career, anything we talked about here or past or future episodes, you can get a hold of us at our new email address, which is MacGuffinPod@gmail.com. And you can also follow us on our social medias, facebook.com/MacGuffinPod and @MacGuffinPod, over at, Twitter and Instagram. And like I said, we're going to be going to WonderCon, probably taking a lot of pictures and posting them as we go. So, you know, follow us on the Instagram to see those go up, and get your WonderCon experience with us. You can follow me over on the MacGuffin's webpage at macguff.in/author/Cassidy. Read the articles I've done there. And while you're there, also check out the other reviews and articles that are being posted weekly by the writers and contributors over at Seattle's MacGuffin. And be sure to read some of the reviews I've done for the Idaho State Journal that I do weekly there, over at the Idaho State Journal's Arts and Entertainment page under my name. And also, what are other things? Oh, I just got us on player.fm and Pocket Cast, so you should now be able to find MacGuffin Podcast, as well as iTunes and Stitcher Radio. So we're almost all the way back to where we were on the platforms, and I think that's all I have to say. What about you?
Check out my website, www.keithfosterkid.com, for upcoming show dates and information. You can follow me on the social medias at Keith Foster Kid.
Yes.
That's Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. So.
Mm-hmm. And you can follow me on Twitter at BC Cassidy, if you so choose. And be sure to check out our friends out there who are doing podcasts of their own, including Patrick and Dennis over at Almost Educational, Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast, Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places, and Rogue Fun, a Star Wars podcast, and Hack Thought over there with Mike Fallick.
Is this the end? Is this the time for my quote at the end of the show? I've got a longer one.
Okay, go for it.
Jeremiah 11:11. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will bring evil upon them, which they shall not be able to escape. And though they shall cry unto me, I will not hearken unto them.